Professor Jennifer Wolch is Dean of the College of Environmental Design at the University of California, Berkeley. She talks with us about how we can build more bugs into our lives by improving our exposure to a large range of biological organisms in order to maintain a healthier microbiome within our bodies. She is one of the pioneer investigators of animal-society relations in cities and has proposed strategies for human-animal coexistence in an urbanizing world. She also has an expertise in urban homelessness and the delivery of affordable housing and human services for poor people. So she shares with us her perspectives on access to toilets for that population within the United States. Dr. Wolch, welcome to Naging Now. I'm really delighted that you've been able to carve out some time from your very busy schedule as Dean of the College of Environmental Design to talk with us.
Pleased to be able to talk to you too.
So as you know, we've been doing a series on digestion and elimination. It may seem far-fetched to think of architecture and environmental design as having something to do with our digestion and elimination. However, we've also been talking about the microbiology of the intestines and also how the microbiology of our internal world interacts with the microbiology of our external world. In that vein, I wanted to talk with you about our interaction with biological organisms and how we live and how we design our communities and our residences, how that promotes or impedes our interaction with biodiversity.
It's a very interesting question. On the one hand, we've over time tried to make buildings more and more cut off from the environment. Inoperable windows, everything's air conditioned. You don't have to go outside to live your basic everyday work life. And there are reasons for that. If you think about tenements in the 19th century and polluted cities, access to the environment often meant access to disease vectors, waterborne, airborne. The environment was full of risk, making buildings, on the one hand, have ventilation, but be places of safety and protection from the outside world was important. We're at a point now where, however, we might want to really think about what the long-term implications of that kind of sealing off are. You know, one of the things that always strikes me is advertisements for antimicrobial soap and sprays. We know that actually we need to build up immunity. We have to actually introduce potentially harmful things into our realm, or else we're going to be more susceptible to attack, as it were. I think we need to think about a happy medium with respect to building design.
Exactly. There's, I think, a couple factors. One is the weather. One of our reasons for sealing off is just comfort. If you live in a colder climate, you really do need to have insulated houses and you need to keep things a little bit airtight. Whereas if you're living in the tropics, you can camp outside.
Certainly climate and comfort are critical. We've done a lot in terms of building science to make buildings comfortable and protect people from the elements. On the other hand, it's possible to have very well insulated buildings in colder climates that allow more circulation of outside air, for example. Technology is getting very, very sophisticated.
Can you explain that a little bit more about what kind of new technologies are making it possible for having more access to outside air while staying energy efficient?
One of the things that's happened over time is that we've built buildings and we've conditioned all the air, assuming that they're basically sealed and the windows don't work. Conditioning very, very large volumes of air, either heating or cooling, when people are actually only exposed to a small fraction of that air. So one thing that you can think about is how to allow occupants to have control over their immediate surrounding environment so they can be warmer or cooler while not having the building quite so sealed up. This is a whole science. But I think that we want to get to a place where we're paying attention to making people comfortable and not just saying this entire, you know, 50-story building has to be at 68 degrees at all time. That kind of shift does two things. One, it may radically increase energy efficiency, and it also gives people more power and control over their immediate environment, and that actually makes people happier and more comfortable and more productive.
Fantastic. That actually reminds me of something that I do. Whenever I don't have guests in my house, I take a hot water bottle
and I put it under my sweater, and that's how I heat myself, and so I don't have to use the central heating, and that's very low cost and low tech.
Yes, and that's a very old, tried and true way of keeping oneself warm. Because we've gotten so used to air conditioning and central heating, we actually forget that you can put on a sweater, that you can wear socks. It does actually make a difference if they use some of these alternative strategies.
So the other part of sealing off our environments, as a child, I would go back with my family to India and visit relatives and grandparents. And their houses were really quite open. And granted, it's India and it's much warmer. But in northern India, it does get cold in the winter as well. There was more interaction with animals. Cats would kind of come in and out of the house, or monkeys. There was a cow in the courtyard. One set of grandparents did have a dog. Peacocks walk through the house. I mean, they'd actually come into the house. And even just geckos and mice. And there wasn't this attempt to necessarily kill them or remove them. They just kind of passed through. The design of the house was with a central courtyard and birds coming in. We don't have that here.
I think in Western culture, we've had a very, very deep-seated way of thinking about nature and culture as these kind of dual spheres. For many, many centuries, the goal has been to master nature, so that culture is dominant over nature, and also, of course, use nature for particular human ends. Also to exclude nature. The nature-culture dualism on the ground translates into city-country. And, of course, we have a long history of walling cities to keep nature out, doing a variety of things to separate people from nature. Now, it has to be said that if you look at European cities in the 19th century or U.S. cities in the 19th century, pigs were roaming down the street, they were eating garbage, and there were a lot of critters around that people didn't necessarily try to exclude. But with more concern about public health, increasing human population densities, and increasing distancing of people from any kind of agrarian experience, you had slaughterhouses and meat markets being moved out of cities. And therefore, you didn't, as an urban resident, you didn't see a drover with cattle driving a herd down your street, or you didn't see pigs. Increasingly, zoning and other kinds of urban planning tools relegated those kinds of agriculturally linked uses to places in the distant suburbs or exurbs. And you had a crackdown in terms of, you know, the kinds of household animals that could be on a site. There's also something that happened in terms of class relations. People who had barnyard animals in their urban properties were seen as somehow related to a lower class. So a sign of a city moving up and having a more prosperous residence was to actually try to marginalize those kinds of uses and make rules against having chickens and cows and goats and pigs and other kinds of animals. At the same time, you have people becoming enthralled with pets. Most cultures have had pets for many, many millennia. Pet keeping is something that is pretty universal around the world. But in the case of Western Europe and the U.S. and also places like Australia, New Zealand, you know, the colonies, you had the rise of a kind of pet fancying culture. This idea that these animals were part of the family, you know, a symbol of that is the rise of the Society for the Protection of Cruelty to Animals, which preceded a lot of the child welfare societies. Mostly it was around harness horses in cities because there was a huge amount of mistreatment and horses dying on the street and so on. We have very curious relations with animals. Some are on a pedestal and protected, others go by the billion into slaughter, and others have a place literally at the dining room table.
Exactly, exactly.
There's a kind of rise of science and technology. I mean, even germ theory, for example, has made people over decades worry about what they're coming in contact with in a way that they perhaps did not before. We have that kind of dynamic that plays out in terms of cleaning products and washing and bathing and all of the routines that we kind of take for granted. But, you know, 100 years ago, people didn't have a shower a day. They didn't use the same kinds of, you know, antibacterial cleaning products. The other thing is, I think that as people have become much more urbanized, their understanding and knowledge about the animal world is radically compromised. That leads to fear and even greater desire to exclude any critter that they don't understand from their midst.
Exactly. You had mentioned also about class differences, at least how people are viewed in terms of their proximity to animals, and that the further you remove yourself from interaction with animals other than domesticated pets, the more, shall we say, sophisticated you are, or urbanized you are, or cosmopolitan you are considered. I wonder if you could speak a little bit more about that.
You've captured the dynamic. Increasingly, people felt that kind of contact with the rough world of agriculture and slaughter and beastliness, uncontrolled animality, was corrupting to people. Sanitizing the environment from that kind of activity became more and more important. The other thing I think to remember also with respect to some of the disease-related fears is that when you have large numbers of people living in badly designed, poorly ventilated structures, you have, you know, a symbiosis with vermin, and they do pose dangers that people have to be aware of. Lots of children living in tenements in New York City at the turn of the century got rat bites. Some of the process of urbanization and the cohabitation that we've, you know, had for millennia with some of these species became problematic.
Yes, you have human population density and animal population density, and to find the right balance is tricky. I know you have some expertise in homelessness, and I also serve a homeless population. Can you speak a little bit about people who are nomadic or unhoused, how they interact with the natural world?
Homeless people who sleep rough are often sleeping in parks or under infrastructure like freeway bridges or in wildland areas on the edge. What I have observed is also that homeless people have animals that they're with.
Yes. So the other issue about being homeless is sanitation. I see increasingly in San Francisco more human excrement on the sidewalks and access to public toilets. It's very hard to find a place where you can eliminate your waste.
This is a huge issue, and it's a political issue. At one point, before the rise of widespread homelessness in the 1980s in the U.S., you had a lot of public restrooms, and you also had stores and restaurants and so on, that gas stations. No one objected if you walked off the street and said, "Can I use the restroom?" Over time, in areas that have more homeless people, store owners, gas stations, lots of other commercial enterprises that would have had restrooms have made those restrooms off limits to anybody except customers. A lot of public restrooms have been closed down because they're such a source of nuisance. So what do homeless people do? Well, you do find excrement in the street, which presents a health problem. It's also a surface runoff contamination issue in terms of the ocean, if it's in large enough amounts. What some communities have done is purchase outdoor restrooms that are self-cleaning after, I don't know how many uses, but periodically they kind of hose themselves down so they're able to keep clean. The problem with all of these kinds of solutions, or porta potties or anything like that, is because homeless people don't have privacy and they don't have places to go, whether they're normal everyday kinds of taking care of yourself, your body, or so on, or it's prostitution, it's drug use, those kinds of uses, the public toilets become places where that activity happens. And that in and of itself becomes a problem, and they can be very dangerous places. I don't know that anybody has developed really adequate solutions to this problem.
So that brings me to the point of our sanitation system. We've designed a system where we put our waste in the water and then we take it out of the water. We're heading into an era where fresh water is going to become a serious scarcity. So I wondered if you had any thoughts about new ways to think about our sanitation system.
Innovative environmental design, or especially landscape architects and also civil engineers, have increasingly looked to alternatives to large-scale sewage treatment, using constructed marshes, for example, constructed wetlands, you know, use biological processes and ecological processes to clean water. We're also seeing a lot more gray water reuse. We can now think about buildings where once a building is supplied with water, that's all it gets. because it is recycling all its water. It's purifying water to such an extent that it's reusable not only for landscaping and other kind of gray water uses, but it's potable. We have obviously a long way to go, but I think technologically we're seeing whole water districts now go toward a sufficiently high level of sewage treatment so that they're able to recycle drinking water. Just like we're going to have buildings that have an energy budget, we're going to have buildings with a water budget.
What do you think about just going waterless?
Composting toilets and technologies such as that, they take a lot of knowledge and maintenance to actually keep them working. I think it's a question about whether they're sufficiently easy at the moment in terms of their technology to be really widespread. We've seen waterless urinals be used in a lot of buildings, a lot of new buildings, and to the extent that they work well, that technology will spread, which also will save water. Experience with composting toilets is such that it's not quite as a generalizable technology as we might hope. The other thing, however, that is happening is places, and I'm here thinking about examples from Mexico, you have very localized treatment plants treating wastewater from small communities. We might begin to see more of that.
There's a lot of discussion about maintaining the biodiversity of this planet, and we're losing species by the minute. How would you propose that we not only improve or maintain our biodiversity as a planet, but also improve our interaction with a larger variety of organisms?
That's a huge question, and it's only going to become more dominant as the climate warms and we're going to have to face whole new ecological regimes that we don't know very much about. On the one hand, there are some very large-scale landscape ecology solutions that we have to deploy much more aggressively. We need linked reserves of wildland habitat to allow enough mobility and enough genetic diversity to be maintained. And I think that's one part of the solution at a landscape level. If you want wolf populations, for example, to thrive, you can't just put them in a bubble and draw a line around them on a map around their reserve area. They need to be able to interact with other wolf populations. They need to re-inhabit perhaps a part of the range that they used to inhabit, or in a changing climate, go to new parts of the range. If you cut them off from those migration and movement patterns, you're going to ultimately lead to local, at least local extirpation, if not extinction. Animals have very, very different home ranges, different migration patterns. They have different needs with respect to how linked the landscape is. I mean, some small creatures, if you put a road in, they're never going to cross that road. How do you think about landscape ecology and landscape architecture in a way that allows for that kind of movement to happen? We have to actually take responsibility for learning a lot more about the animals that we interact with. You know, we're not used to being part of the food chain, and we don't want to be part of the food chain. I don't want to be eaten by a cougar in the Berkeley Hills. But on the other hand, we have the responsibility to accept the risk that comes along with being part of an ecosystem, and to minimize the risks, we need to really be much more knowledgeable about the natural world in which we live.
Animals are kind of a vector for disease-producing agents, but also normal microbiological agents that would actually be beneficial for the diversity of our microbiome inside our bodies. Also, just interacting with plants and soil. Do you have any suggestions of how we could design our lives or our living environments or our cities or our spaces so that we actually have more fruitful interactions with soils and plants?
People's desires to have access to soils and plants is really powerful. It's a challenge, I think about vertical cities, dense cities, especially in Asia, which, you know, it's really the only way you're going to preserve agricultural land and habitat is to really have dense places. You have to design them with the understanding that people want and need access to plants and soils, and at least some kinds of wildlife. I think what you're seeing is the rise of green roofs, the rise of mid-level gardens in tall buildings. You also see some buildings that have foliage on their outsides. That's kind of trendy. More importantly, you're going to see building designs that have enough natural ventilation and air circulation that they can actually support gardens as part of the design, not just the roofs, but other parts of building decks, building floor plates that will be exposed or be conservatories or other places where people can interact.
Given all you know about the importance of interacting with a large diversity of organisms, would you prefer to live in an urban environment or a rural environment?
Cities have a lot to offer, and I think that in the U.S. in particular, there's been a long history of anti-urban sentiment and an idea that, you know, you're really more genuine, you're a real person if you live in a rural environment. And it goes back to Thomas Jefferson and the idea of agrarian democracy and also pollution of industrial cities. Many people left Europe to get away from that. It's a complex set of ideas about cities. The fact is that cities are generators of ideas, of culture, of change, dynamism, and innovation. So they're very important. And I also think that they're important from a wildlife perspective, because if everybody lived at low densities, you know, in exurban areas, we would be just chewing up more habitat than we're already chewing up, which is horrendous. The key is building nature into everyday urban environments in a way that gives people a lot of access, including places to grow food, which is very satisfying.
Great. Do you have anything else you'd like to add?
I just want to thank you for a great conversation.
Excellent. I've enjoyed it as well. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.
Professor Jennifer Wolch, Dean of the College of Environmental Design at the University of California, Berkeley. Tete